says, you guys can go home. And not all of them go home, but a good number of them go home. And Ezra, the first six chapters of Ezra, tells the story of this first group of Jews who, when Cyrus, the king of Persia, says you can go home, they go home. About 50,000 Jews go home. And in the first six chapters here of Ezra, they reestablish their community in Judah, primarily in Jerusalem. And they start to rebuild the temple, and then they run into some difficulties and problems, and it takes them a while, but 20 years later, they finally finish the temple. And that's the climax, or the triumph, of the first six chapters of Ezra. And this is kind of the outline for Ezra, the first six chapters, the restoration of the temple. Now, at this point, Ezra is not on the scene. I mean, it's his book, and he's writing it, but he's, at this point, writing about something that happened many years ago. In fact, at least 50 years, perhaps as many as 80 years have passed between Ezra chapter 6 and Ezra chapter 7. And it is only in Ezra chapter 7 that Ezra actually comes on the scene. And this is indicated by the occurrence of the we or I passages that start there. The first group of Israelites, or people of Judah, who came back from captivity were led primarily by Zerubbabel, who was the grandson of Jeconiah, who was the last legitimate king of Judah. So Zerubbabel is in the royal line, but he leads the people, but he's not king. They're still under the control of the Persian Empire. And so he's a governor. Or at least at some point he becomes a governor. There's this other fellow that's referred to as a governor who may actually be Zerubbabel, but we're not really sure. But there's Zerubbabel, and then there's also the high priest Joshua, or Jeshua. And these two men are the leaders of the community that come back from captivity and rebuild the temple. And at some point, the prophets Haggai and Zechariah get involved because they're the ones who encourage the people of Judah to rebuild the temple. And so they're involved in the first six chapters of Ezra as well. So that's what's going on here. And we're going to start here in chapter 1 of Ezra and hopefully cover a few chapters anyway tonight. And that's where we're at, so that's where we'll start. Well, before we go any further, let's go ahead and have a word of prayer. And James, would you mind directing us in the prayer? Amen. Now, the book of Ezra is really a very hopeful book, a very positive book, because it's a book about restoration, about return, redemption, that the nation was not lost, that it got close to being lost, but it wasn't lost, and a remnant of God's people returned and were able to rebuild. And it begins with this fellow Cyrus in verse 1, chapter 1, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia. In order to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he sent a proclamation throughout all his kingdom and also put it in writing, saying, go home. We talked about this Cyrus cylinder, which is a document that was found in Babylon, which records the proclamation that Cyrus made for various peoples who had been dislocated by the Babylonians, that they could go home, that they should go home and rebuild their sanctuaries. And so this statement that's made here in Ezra chapter 1 is perfectly in keeping with what we know historically took place according to this document right here. You know, I said that it was Isaiah who said that Cyrus would do this. And it was Isaiah. So this reference here to Jeremiah is Jeremiah's prophecy that after 70 years, the captivity would come to an end. And that prophecy is made in Jeremiah chapter 25 and verse 12, and also in Jeremiah 29 and verse 10. Now, Jeremiah doesn't mention Cyrus. He just mentions the fact they'll get to go home. It's Isaiah who prophesied that it would be Cyrus who did that. And that's found in Isaiah 45 and verse 1, and also in Isaiah 45 and verse 13. Now, what's remarkable about that, well, there's a lot of remarkable things about it, but Isaiah lived around 700 B.C. Cyrus issued this decree in 538 B.C. So we're talking about something like 160 years before Cyrus ever came on the scene. Isaiah prophesied and said, or God said through Isaiah, I'm going to raise up Cyrus, and he is the one who is going to make this happen. That he's going to rebuild my city, so to speak, which is a remarkable prophecy. Jeremiah predicted that it would be a 70-year captivity, and that's what this reference is here in Ezra chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. Yes, sir? That's right. That's right. Okay, so Cyrus issues this decree, and he says, go back to Jerusalem, rebuild your temple. And this is a very important decree and proclamation, because many years later, after they were discouraged and stopped from rebuilding the temple, they started to rebuild the temple again, and once again they ran into opposition from some of the other surrounding rulers. And they appealed back to the capital, back to the king of Persia. And a search was made in the record. Indeed, they found, and then we'll see this in chapter 6, they found the decree of Cyrus. And so that decree was very important to actually getting the job done in the end of rebuilding the temple. Oh, yes. Yes, he's like the foundational king, and so anything that he would have to say took precedence over anything else. That's right. And so that was very impressive. In fact, it was so impressive, we'll see this in chapter 6, that when they found that decree, not only did they say, yes, they can rebuild the temple, they told all of those opposing rulers, you have to contribute to it, because this has got to get done. And so the tables were turned on them. So this is very important, this decree from Cyrus. And of course, it's from God. The Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, to do that. And so by way of prophecy, Isaiah 45:1, by way of prophecy, Jeremiah 25, God knew this was going to happen because God was going to make it happen. And that's the thing about prophecy. You know, we often think of prophecy as simply God saying what's going to happen because he knows what's going to happen, but it's not quite the case. Not just that God knows what's going to happen. God's going to make it happen. He's going to see to it that it happens. Yeah. Yes. Yep. Complete change of policy. Yes. Yes. That's right. You could have said at the time that the captivity took place, that these guys are never going to come back. It's unprecedented that they would ever get to come back. But God is a very good changer of precedent. He's somebody who can overrule and override the will of men. You know? That's right. So God stirred up Cyrus to do this. Josephus tells the story that the Jews actually showed Cyrus the prophecy in Isaiah, written 160 years earlier, that said that he would do this, and that this is what prompted him to issue this decree. It could be that Josephus made that up, but it was a tradition among the Jews anyway. So the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, and he said, go home. We see here in verse 3, whoever is among all his people, may his God be with him. Let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, rebuild the house of the Lord and the God of Israel. He is the God who is in Jerusalem. Now, that all makes it sound like Cyrus was a real believer in Jehovah God, but just as it says on the cylinder, he said the same thing about all the other gods. And we have to get in the mindset of polytheists, pagans. They give credit to every god. Every god, everybody's god is a god, and so they need to all be honored, and they all need to be respected, and you know, in their way of thinking, all of these other gods, by respecting them, is ultimately respecting the god that Cyrus would serve, because that's the god who put Cyrus in charge. You know, so it's all the same in a pagan's mind. Yes, yeah, and the Greeks as well, yeah. And so, you know, you just have to understand this language from, you know, this is the way that Cyrus would have meant it, but of course God, he can use people's foolishness to his own ends as well. Every survivor, verse 4, every survivor at whatever place he may live, let the men of that place support him with silver and gold, with goods and cattle, together with a freewill offering for the house of God, which is in Jerusalem. This is essentially a second Exodus, because you remember when the Israelites left Egyptian captivity, God compelled the Egyptians by the plague to send them out with gifts and with gold and silver and many precious items. And so it's kind of like a repeat of that. By God stirring up Cyrus to do this, they are sent out with many gifts and gold and silver so that they can return home and rebuild the temple. And so that's an amazing thing when all together. Something else. And Ezra's always all about making these connections between the past and what is reestablished. And so we have the next segment of this chapter, verse 5. The heads of the fathers' households, of Judah and Benjamin, the priests and the Levites arose, even everyone whose spirit God had stirred up to go and rebuild the house of the Lord, which is in Jerusalem. So God stirred up Cyrus, and he also stirred up the hearts of the people of Israel. And it names them specifically, the people of Judah and of Benjamin. And the mission was not just to go home, but to go home and rebuild the temple. And that's this whole section of Ezra 1 through 6. That's where it's all headed, to rebuild the temple. And until that temple is rebuilt, they haven't completed the task. And they haven't really returned yet. In my opinion, it is the destruction of the temple and the rebuilding and completion of the temple, which is actually the 70-year bracket. And the reason I say that is because if you look at how it's referred to, where is that reference? I forget where it's at. But in Zechariah, I think it's in Zechariah, when they actually finish the temple, it refers to it like this is the 70 years. But anyway, that's my opinion. So God stirs them up to return. And verse 6, and all those about them encourage them with articles of silver and gold and goods and cattle and so forth. Verse 7, also King Cyrus brought out the articles of the house of the Lord. Here's another connection There's a physical, tangible, artifact connection between the destruction of the old temple and the rebuilding of the new temple. And that is some of this same, these same vessels have been preserved. And so the communication of Ezra is that there has been a preservation. The people have been preserved. Some of these articles have been preserved. It can be reestablished. The roots are still there. And so King Cyrus issues this decree and says, you pull all of these vessels and implements and things that the Babylonians took away and have been stored away or have been reused or put in the service of pagan gods. You bring those out and you give them to the Jews and let them take those things back. Verse 8, Cyrus, king of Persia, had them brought out by the hand of Mithridath, the treasurer, and he counted them out to Sheshbazzar, the prince of Judah, which actually means translated governor of Judah. So there's this fellow Sheshbazzar who is called the governor of Judah. And he may be the same guy as Zerubbabel, but probably not. And you remember when Daniel and his companions were taken and put into the service of the king of Babylon, they all got new names, right? They got names that were foreign names. Well, Sheshbazzar may actually be Zerubbabel's foreign name, but we don't know that for a fact. We know this guy Sheshbazzar is called the governor, and later on in Haggai, Zerubbabel is called the governor of Judah, but it may be at a later date that he became governor. But anyway, this guy is the one who received these vessels, and they were put in his charge so that he could take them and return to Jerusalem for the reestablishment of the temple. And it actually numbers them. It numbers all of these items. And this is what you see, this very careful enumeration of people and stuff in the book of Ezra, because it is a record, it's a document that records this very important reconstruction, reestablishment of the sanctuary worship in Jerusalem. That's right. That's right. Because, yeah, there needs to be an accounting. All the articles of gold and silver numbered 5,400. Sheshbazzar brought them up, all up with the exiles who went up from Babylon to Jerusalem. And those last words, from Babylon to Jerusalem, that's the kicker at the end of that chapter. They actually got back to Jerusalem from Babylon. Any thoughts or questions about chapter 1? Anybody except Wesley? All right. So, yeah. Yeah. It's a common theme, of course. The first one is Noah and his family. But even Abraham, you start, all of these stories start with this small core group of people. And they go out, and they're like seeds that get planted, and something grows from them. And, of course, the Israelites go down into Egypt, children of Jacob go down to Egypt, and they come out a great nation, and they return. But always, there's these periods of cleansing, of driving out the sin. A remnant, it remains, and it returns and starts the process over again. And ultimately, that's what the church is. It starts with a handful of. No. Now, we've talked about that. We don't know what happened to the Ark of the Covenant. It could have been taken by the Babylonians. I sort of doubt that it was still there by that point, but we just don't know. Yeah. Oh, certainly, yeah. You know, it was actually a wood box covered with gold. So it didn't have quite the oomph to it that you see in the movie Raiders of the Lost Ark. What's that? Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes. Whittling away. And it can't ever be lost. We receive a kingdom that cannot be shaken. That's right. Absolutely. Now, let's go ahead and look at this other, you know, we've got the vessels, but now we got the people. The people are more important even than the vessels. They get to come back too. And here's the real remnant. All of these categories, and it's laid out in a very orderly way. First, we start with the leaders. First verse mentions, first two verses mentions these leaders. These are the people of the province who came up out of captivity of the exiles from Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, and carried away to Babylon and returned to Jerusalem and Judah, each to his city. The first two names, the leaders, Zerubbabel, Jeshua or Joshua, Nehemiah, Zariah, Reeliah, Mordecai, Belshan, Mizpar, Bivga, Rehum, and Bana. Now, don't get confused here. Nehemiah and Mordecai, who are named here, are not the Nehemiah that we read about later in the book of Nehemiah, and Mordecai, who's in the story of Esther. Those are very common names. And these guys were just named that. When Nehemiah lists these same guys in his record, he has one more that apparently got dropped off here. And the significance of that is that it would make an even 12 names, which has symbolic significance. But Joshua and Zerubbabel are the two most important leaders. So that's the first thing you have. You have the leaders. Then, starting in the latter part of verse 2, the number of the men of the people of Israel, and from verse 3 all the way through verse 20, you have families. And for each of these families, the name that is given here is probably somebody back in the genealogy. It's not the actual guy who came with Zerubbabel and Joshua and returned, but all of the people who are part of that clan. These are clan names, in other words. And so these are the guys who can trace their connection to these clans. This is my family. This is my connection to the past. And so it gives legitimacy to their claim to be returning Israelites. Starting in verse 20 and on down through verse 34, 35, these are towns. These are the people who came back, who came from these towns. So it's another way of enumerating or giving a connection to the past. I came from a family in this town, and I'm coming back to this town, and that documents my participation in this legitimate return of the people of Israel to their towns. And so there's that. And then you have in verses 36 through 39, the priests. And it lists four families of priests. And again, the names of these priests, the sons of Jediah, the sons of Immer, the sons of Pashur, the sons of Harim, these are guys back down the line in the genealogy. And it's four of the 24, what's that word again? I always forget that word. They're the groups of priests. Courses. 24 courses of priests that had been established by David and Solomon. They divided all the priests up in 24 courses. And they divided up the time of the year in which each course would serve in the temple. Because there's too many guys to be working all at the same time. So they took turns. Well, of the 24 courses, only four came back. Only four came back. But by the time later in the story, the 24 courses were reestablished. And the thinking is that, and I think that the Jewish tradition corroborates this, is all they did was they divided these four families of priests that still survived, they redivided them eventually into the 24 courses again to reestablish that practice. But again, it's very important that this be documented, that these priests are legitimate, they're actually descended from these guys, and they have returned to take up again the practice of the priesthood. Starting in verse 40, you have a list of the Levites. And there's actually a lot more priests than there are Levites. Altogether, there were something like 4,000, a little over 4,000 priests. But of the Levites, there's only maybe, if you take the total at the end of verse 42, 139. Perhaps maybe you can combine the 74 with the 139. But basically, you've got less than 10% of the number of priests, you have Levites. Which is kind of interesting because, of course, at one time, the Levites would have greatly outnumbered the priests. Because the Levites were the whole tribe, and the priests were only the descendants from Aaron. But, apparently, of those who returned, the priests were more into it. They were more involved, more interested in coming back than many of the Levites. And so not very many Levites returned. But many of the temple servants, verse 43, so this is the next class of people, the temple servants, the sons of Ziha, the sons of Eshbah, the sons of Tabhoth, and so on and so forth. And that goes on down a ways. Now you think, well, aren't those Levites? Probably not. They're probably men who had been assigned, and there were these men that were selected by Solomon from various families and even among foreigners, and they did a lot of the menial work and tasks and so forth, and that's probably who these guys are. And then you have in verse 55 the sons of Solomon's servants. So this is another class of people and another class of functionaries or servants who had been in the service of the king. And all of those guys were 392 at the end of verse 58. And so then you get to, in verse 59, at the tail end, people who you can't really be sure whether their claim is legitimate or not. Verse 59, now these are those who came up from Tel Mela and Tel Harsha, Cherub and Adan. Nemer. Now, these names are names of towns in Babylon. And so he's saying these are people who came from these towns in Babylon, but they were not able to give evidence of their fathers' households and their descendants, whether they were of Israel. And so they kind of formed a different group, kind of the tail end of things. And then we have some priests who could not prove that they were actually from the right lineage. Verse 61, the sons of the priests, the sons of Habiah, the sons of Hakoz, the sons of Barzillai, who took a wife from the daughters of Barzillai, the Gileadite, and he was called by their name. These searched among their ancestral registration, but they could not be located, and therefore they were considered unclean and were excluded from the priesthood. And this is very important. It's important because it shows the degree to which they were being careful, that they were making sure that they had documentation to say, yes, these priests are legitimate priests. And the reason that we know that is because there was some guys who they couldn't find the records for, and they excluded them. And the exclusion, the exception, proves the rule. It proves that they were being devoted to the law of Moses. And so it's a very interesting fact. Okay. Got to follow the law. Got to follow the rules. And if you can't prove it, then you can't do it. It's a very important, interesting concept of authority. If you can't document it, if you can't substantiate it, then don't do it. We're okay. Verse 63, the governor said to them that they should not eat from the most holy things until a priest stood up with Urim and Thummim. So they established a means by which they could perhaps at some point be legitimized if there could be a priest who could stand up with Urim and Thummim. And the whole assembly numbered 42,360 besides their male and female servants, verse 65, who numbered 7,337, and they had 200 singing men and women. Who knows who they were? Their horses were 736, their mules 245, their camels 435, and their donkeys 6,700. And 20. And so that's the enumeration. That's the census. That's the seriousness with which they made this return. They even counted every single last donkey. And some of the heads of the fathers' households, when they arrived in the house of the Lord, which was in Jerusalem, offered willingly the house of God to restore it on its foundations according to their ability. Where does that show up later on? Yeah. Some people feel that Paul was actually quoting this very verse when he said that to the Corinthians. Each according to their ability. They give to the treasury for the work 61,000 gold drachmas, 5,000 silver minas, and 100 priestly garments. The priests and the Levites and some of the people, the singers, the gatekeepers, and the temple servants lived in their cities and all Israel in their cities. We have a dramatic conclusion at the end of chapter 2. Enumeration of all these various groups of people who returned, their legitimacy, their lineage, and they returned and they lived in the cities that their families originally came from. And so that's a restoration. Great. Wonderful. Any comment or thoughts about any of that? Chapter 3. Now, you would think the first thing they would do is want to build the temple. But they didn't. The first thing you have to build is the altar. Why do you have to build the altar first before you can build the temple? Okay. The altar is where you make the sacrifices, and the sacrifices are necessary to cleanse the people, to make them pure. You can't build a temple with impure hands. You have to first have sacrifices. That means you first have to have an altar. And in fact, whenever like Abraham or one of the patriarchs or when Israel comes into the land, the first thing they do is build an altar because you need to sacrifice to God. And so that's the sacrificial system's basis for everything. So the first thing you do is build an altar. Now, it took them a while to build the altar. And it says here in chapter 3 and verse 1, "Now when the seventh month came, and the sons of Israel were in the cities, and the people gathered together as one man to Jerusalem." That's a great phrase, isn't it? "As one man to Jerusalem. Then Jeshua, the son of Jehozadak, and his brothers, the priests, and Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and his brothers arose and built the altar of God of Israel to offer burnt offerings on it, as it is written in the law of Moses, the man of God." That's a great verse. "As it is written in the law of Moses, the man of God." So they follow the law. Why the seventh month? It says in verse 6, "From the first day of the seventh month, they began to offer burnt offerings." Well, it's the first day of the seventh month that is actually a holiday. It's a day of observance that's given in the law of Moses. Leviticus 23 and verse 24 is the day of trumpets. You blow the trumpets, and it's also a day of Sabbath, of rest. And so, you know, it's the first main day of observance that they have a chance to rebuild this altar and start the process of reobserving these special events. And in verse 4, it says, "They celebrated the Feast of Booths, as is written, and offered the fixed number of burnt offerings daily according to the ordinance of each day required. And afterward, there was a continual burnt offering also for the new moons and all for all the fixed festivals of the Lord. And they were consecrated, and from everyone who offered a freewill offering to the Lord." And so it reestablished this sequence of festivals and sacrifices and observances. But it says at the end of verse 6, "The tenth foundation of the temple of the Lord had not been laid." So now they had to need make preparation for that. In verse 7, "They gave money to the masons, the carpenters, and the food and food and drink and all oil to the Sidonians and the Tyrians to bring cedar wood from Lebanon to the sea at Joppa, according to the permission they had from Cyrus, king of Persia." Well, what we have here is basically a recital or a revisiting of the same process that happened in the building of the first temple. Where did Solomon get his wood? From the Sidonians, from the people of Tyre. That's right. So they're going back over old territory here. Bring all the wood down from the cedars of Lebanon to rebuild the temple, just like Solomon had done. In chapter 8, "Now in the second year of their coming to the house of God in Jerusalem, and in the second month of Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Jeshua, the son of Jehozadak, and the rest of the brothers and priests, Levites, and all who came from the captivity of Jerusalem, began the work and appointed Levites from 20 years old and over to oversee the work of the house of the Lord." That's also a revisiting of something that Solomon did. Solomon had begun the rebuilding of the first temple, or the building of the first temple, in the second month, the first day of the second month of the year. And they repeat that. They start in the second month rebuilding the temple. Then Jeshua with his sons and brothers stood united with Kadmiel and his sons, the sons of Judah, and the sons of Henadad, with their sons and brothers, Levites, to oversee the workmen in the temple of God. And they start building. They start building the foundation of the temple of God. So it's all good. And we'll have to stop there. Thank you.